explores how American politics became trivial and stupid. Also, the history of the first cartoon superstar, Felix the Cat. We talk with animation historian John Canemaker. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers West Texas rocker Buddy Knox. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Today in New Delhi, mourners mobbed the coffin of slain Indian leader Rajiv Gandhi. The government imposed strict security measures across the country yesterday after Gandhi was assassinated by a bomb blast at an election rally. Officials feared that the attack might provoke riots like those that killed about 1,200 people after the shooting of Gandhi's mother, Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, in 1984. Some 200 people are already said to have been killed in violence during the current election campaign. The remaining 2 days of voting in the general elections have been postponed for 3 weeks. Syrian and Lebanese officials signed a broad-ranging treaty today, one that Israeli officials have been highly critical of, saying it threatens Israeli security. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Damascus.
The treaty signed today binds the two Arab neighbors in something larger than a treaty, but less than a union. The agreement means that Syria will have a hand in Lebanon's security arrangements, its economic life, and military policy. The arrangements follows an agreement worked out by Arab states and Taif, Saudi Arabia, to end Lebanon's civil war. Syria has more than 40,000 troops in Lebanon. The agreement calls for withdrawal of those forces from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, by next fall. It's unlikely that Syria will withdraw entirely from Lebanon as long as Israel controls a strip of Lebanon in the south. Not all Lebanese welcome today's agreement. Some of Lebanon's representatives from the Maronite Christian community stayed away from the signing ceremony. In Damascus, this is Deborah Amos.
Secretary of State James Baker is using unusually harsh words to criticize Israel's policy of establishing settlements in the occupied territories. George Guetta reports from the State Department.
The administration has long been opposed to Israel's settlements policy, contending that it is an obstacle to peace. But Baker, in testimony before a House Foreign Affairs subcommittee, escalated his criticism by saying the settlements substantially weaken his efforts to set up Arab-Israeli peace talks. His frustration was evident when he said there has been a new announcement on settlement activity coinciding with each of his last 4 visits to Israel, dating back to March. He said the Israeli policy is the biggest obstacle blocking the start of Arab-Israeli peace talks. Otherwise, Baker was upbeat about the chances for launching a peace process, saying there is more agreement than disagreement among Arabs and Israelis on the key aspects of his proposals. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
Palestinian sources in Israel say that 2 Arab men were killed today for allegedly collaborating with the Israeli army. The army confirmed the death of one man who was shot by Palestinian activists in his home village in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian activists are reported to have killed 345 fellow Arabs since the beginning of the Arab uprising more than 3 years ago. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained just over 4 points today to close at 2,910. This is NPR. The House defied a veto threat from President Bush today and passed a defense budget that slashes the administration's request for the B-2 stealth bomber and the Strategic Defense Initiative. Supporters of the $291 billion bill said it reflects the end of the Cold War and the lessons learned from the Persian Gulf War. The budget passed on a vote of 268 to 161. The president has threatened to veto the measure because it doesn't meet his request for strategic weapons and because it doesn't cut reserve forces as much as he wanted. The National Rifle Association is threatening a lawsuit against Chicago's public housing agency, which bans the possession of firearms on its property. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
Rules prohibiting firearms and ammunition have been on the Chicago Housing Authority's books for 20 years, but the agency has begun enforcing those rules in earnest only during the last 3 years, with a series of surprise inspections at public housing developments. A resident whose apartment was searched complained to the NRA, which agreed to fight the government-funded housing authority in court if it doesn't change the rules. The Washington-based gun lobby says that the sweeps violate residents' constitutional right to bear arms. Chicago Housing Authority officials say that the sweeps have reduced gun-related crime and that the agency has the right to keep firearms off its property as long as the restriction applies to all residents. At present, the agency can evict tenants who have guns in their apartments. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
U.S. officials said today that most of Iraq's weapons-grade nuclear material survived massive Allied bombings during the Persian Gulf War. That assessment was based on a report made by an international team that inspected both Iraq's accessible uranium and the sites where the rest of it is believed to be buried. The team said Iraq accurately recorded the condition of its nuclear facilities after the bombing. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We Americans pride ourselves on our democracy, but let's face it, when it comes to American politics, we're a pretty cynical bunch. As my guest E.J. Dion puts it, for most of us, politics is a spectator sport barely worth watching. Dion writes for The Washington Post, where he will soon start a new column about politics and ideas. He's a former New York Times reporter. Dion's new book has the provocative title, Why Americans Hate Politics.
I think Americans have looked at the last 25 years of political campaigns, and what they see is a constant repetition of phony, divisive debates over cultural issues that either they've settled in their own minds or are meaningless. For example, if you look at how we argue about crime, people are legitimately worried about crime. But what we get in our campaigns instead is an endless argument over the death penalty. Now, there's a lot to say about the death penalty, but most people know that the death penalty won't do much about the crimes most people care about, rapes, robberies, murders, even. And that what they want is a real debate about how you solve the crime problem, and instead they get this symbolic debate about the death penalty. You could go through issue after issue after issue where what people are looking for from politics is some sense of solution and resolution of disputes, and what they get instead is this phony argument over and over.
Now, why are you very worried about the fact that Americans hate politics?
Well, I'm worried about it because we think of ourselves as a democracy, and we think of ourselves as a country that's special in the world because we are a democracy. And what we're getting is a country which is more fed up with democracy than all kinds of countries which have not known democracy for a long time. I think also that our politics is getting in the way of solving problems instead of helping to solve them. For example, on the talk about the family and what we're going to do about the family, what we've had in a lot of cases, especially in divisive political campaigns, is a debate which casts feminism and the traditional family as enemies of each other. Most people, in fact, have come to a number of conclusions on this issue. They are Americans as a whole are feminists in the sense that they believe that men and women are equal and should be treated equally. They also believe in the family and worry about how new arrangements we've created might be shortchanging children. What they want is a debate about how can you treat men and women equally and treat kids well at the same time. What they're getting instead is this debate which will not get us closer to resolving that central question.
What are some of the other recent low points in American politics that lead you to the conclusion that our politics have become trivial and stupid?
Well, for example, the Willie Horton campaign. Willie Horton became the central issue. Willie Horton, the man who was furloughed from a Massachusetts prison when he was there on a murder sentence and committed rape while he was on furlough. Now, the problem with the Willie Horton issue is that ought to be a unifying issue. Black Americans and white Americans are both terribly worried about how it is that we as a society are producing folks like Willie Horton. What is it that we're doing wrong? What is it in our social structure, in the structure of our opportunities that create Willie Hortons? What we got instead is this debate that really was tinged with racism and that appealed to people's emotions on race rather than discussing how can we solve this problem? How can we deal with something that is of concern to both black and white Americans? And that's the sort of thing that upsets me about what's happened to our politics, and I think it's why people have come to hate politics so.
What do you think about the way the debate about the Gulf War was carried out before the war started?
Well, actually, to my mind, that was a good moment. It was a rare time when you really saw people taking each other's arguments seriously. And it wasn't until after the war where people challenged each other's motives. At the time, people really said, look, we agree largely that Saddam Hussein is a bad guy and a menace. And the question is, how are we as a country going to deal with this? And that debate was very powerful and I think gave people a sense of how politics could be carried out if things went well in our country.
If you're just joining us, my guest is E.J. Dion. He writes for The Washington Post. He's about to start a political column at the Post. His new book is called Why Americans Hate Politics. Do you think that the problem with politics today gets back to the system? Is it the system, the pollsters, the this and that, that's responsible for the superficiality? Or do you think that it's the ideology within the party, within the parties themselves, that's responsible for the superficiality and triviality that we all complain about?
Well, see, I think we have had a difficult time ever since what I call in the book the Cultural Civil War of the 1960s. That from, say, the end of World War II until the beginning of the 60s, the country felt itself at some kind of basic consensus on values, on lifestyles, on all of the rest. And so politics really did focus on a series of practical things that most people cared about. What happened in the 1960s is what I think was a necessary revolt against that kind of consensus politics. Feminists demanded a larger role for women. The civil rights movement demanded a larger role for black people. And on both the right and the left, there was a sense that that consensus that dominated the country had become a little bit too full of itself and was really unwilling to listen to arguments and counterarguments. And then, of course, there was the Vietnam War, which really tore us apart as a country. I think that we went through this necessary debate. The problem is the debate has lingered long past its time, that most Americans have actually made peace on those issues, that in some ways I'm reminded when I think of the Cultural Civil War about a line Bruce Babbitt used to use in his 1988 presidential campaign for the Democratic nomination. He used to say, look, the Cold War is over, we've won. And I think the Cultural Civil War is largely over, and that liberal values in a whole series of areas have triumphed. And I think it's a mistake, especially for liberals, to try to continue to push on with this debate. I think the time has come to consolidate certain gains and see if one can marry the real gains that have been made by blacks, by feminists, marry those to what most middle-class Americans see as traditional values. I don't see that as an impossible marriage. I think that is the kind of marriage the country is looking for, if I can use a very traditional word like marriage.
What would be an example of how liberal values that triumphed in the 60s could be matched to traditional values? Give us an example.
Well, for example, it seems to me when we talk a lot these days about women in the workforce and about how are we going to take care of children when so many families have both parents out at work. One of the problems that always comes up is if a parent decides to take leave for a period of 6 or 8 months or a year to take care of the young child, what's going to happen to that person when they come back to work? Usually that person is a woman, and usually that person faces discrimination when she gets back to work in the sense that her job opportunities, her opportunities for promotion have been retarded by the fact that she decided to take a year off to take care of a kid. Now, is it pro-feminist or is it pro-family to say that's not fair, that if we value what this person does as a parent, we're not going to discriminate against them when they come back to work? I think it's both pro-feminist and pro-family to say we want that to stop.
Now, what do you think is holding back political candidates from addressing issues on a really practical level?
Well, I think
and trying to reach some kind of consensus, some kind of middle that you're talking about that unites people who ordinarily see themselves as being on opposite sides.
Well, I think that a couple of things have happened. I think conservatives gained a lot of ground by using divisive cultural issues to further their cause. What they did is they got a lot of votes from lower middle income, mainly white voters, by making these their central issues. Now, the conservatives have a problem because part of their constituency is this group of whites of modest income who basically like big government in a lot of areas. They want to cut taxes, but they don't want to cut big government. They like traditional values. The other part of the conservative constituency tends to be very well off. They tend to be pro-choice on everything from free markets to abortion. They don't want big government in any area. The conservatives, if they move boldly on anything, will blow their coalition apart. They will either lose this lower income wing or this upper income wing. So for conservatives, I think there's a powerful interest in keeping politics focused on these false choices on cultural issues. For liberals, it's much more complicated. I think that the main thing that happened to liberals in the 60s is that because they found themselves on the right side of history on civil rights, because they were right in saying it was time we did something for black Americans who had been discriminated against, what they did is they developed the great sin of people who are on that who are on the right side of history, which is moralism. And when white middle-class Americans said, look, my taxes have gone way up, way beyond where they should be. Liberals tended to say these folks are selfish. When these folks complained about crime, they were accused of being racist when what they were really worried about is crime. So I think liberals gave this opening to conservatives on cultural issues, and conservatives are continuing to play that card as long as they can. I think liberals need to make peace with the broad middle class, and that if they did that, they could actually do more for these other values that they also represent.
Well, how would they do that? How are you suggesting liberals try to make peace with the mainstream?
Well, for example, I think there's a whole other area, which is taxation. That one of the things that happened in the 1980s and also before the 1980s is that taxes became much heavier on middle-income Americans. And taxes went up most on middle-income Americans with children. It seems to me liberals could argue that it is both pro-family and very progressive to start cutting tax rates on middle-income families, especially those who are performing the most important social job there is in the country, which is bringing up children. You're seeing some of this happening in Congress. A couple of weeks ago, Senator Gore, Representative Downey, George Miller of California, and Representative Obie introduced a tax bill to do just this, to cut taxes on middle and lower income people and really concentrate benefits on families with children.
Now, I just want to say, you're arguing that these false choices are based on ideological differences within each of the political camps. But I still think the argument can be made that these false choices are being presented because it takes too long to really discuss the issues. And you can't do that in a soundbite. And if you really discuss the issues, you might alienate somebody. And everybody's terrified of doing that. That nobody seems to really want to take the time in politics to actually discuss an issue.
Well, I agree with you to the extent that I think both broad coalitions, Democrat and liberal, Republican and conservative, are shot through with contradictions, and they're worried about blowing those coalitions apart. I think that for conservatives, in a way, you can't blame conservatives for trying to keep the discussion on a road that's been very helpful to them up to now. I think they are running out of gas, and I think people are going to start asking more of them, but that's worked for them. For liberals, frankly, I don't understand why they don't try to change this discussion, because it's clearly been so damaging to them, the way we have discussed politics in the last 20 years. And I think that you're going to start seeing liberals try to change the discussion because they realize that they're just going to keep losing presidential elections if they don't. I think something else happened to our politics back in the 60s that, to me, two crucial events were the Goldwater campaign and the McGovern campaign. Now, I happen to admire both Goldwater and McGovern as very honest and decent human beings, but the fact of the matter is both of their movements represented the interests of different wings of the upper middle class, that the Goldwater movement was a group of essentially upper middle class people who were concerned about communism and high taxes and big government. The McGovern constituency was another group of upper middle class people who were concerned primarily with foreign policy, foreign intervention, and abstract rights, if you will. That this debate between Goldwaterism and McGovernism has dominated our politics. Most Americans aren't either Goldwaterite or McGovernite. Most of them aren't engaged by these issues. What they are looking for are practical remedies. And that's why I think we created a problem for ourselves when those two wings became so powerful in the parties. It's not even a question of being left-wing and right-wing. It's a question of what issues really engage them, and I think that's what was wrong.
Well, how powerful did they really become, though? It was, after all, Nixon that got into the White House.
It is, but I think that what Nixon found when he got in the White House, actually, there's an interesting paradox. I mean, you can't talk about Richard Nixon without using the words either paradox or irony. And I think that the paradox of the Nixon administration is that if you go back and look at his record, on an awful lot of issues, Richard Nixon was quite a bit more liberal than, say, Jimmy Carter. That the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, got created under Nixon. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration got created under Nixon. We indexed Social Security under Nixon. Nixon had this relatively liberal record on a whole series of domestic issues. But Nixon made a decision in 1972 that if he ran as a liberal, it really wouldn't help him nearly as much as if he ran on these divisive social issues. And so he ran against busing. He ran against what he called acid amnesty and abortion. And so I think Nixon took what is a fairly moderate political position and gave it a much more right-wing cast, which I think put us down this road, and that acid amnesty and abortion is not all that different from Willie Horton and the Pledge of Allegiance.
If you're just joining us, my guest is E.J. Dionne. He writes for The Washington Post, where he's about to start a new column on politics and ideas. And he's the author of the new book, Why Americans Hate Politics. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Washington Post writer E.J. Dionne is my guest, author of the new book, Why Americans Hate Politics. Now, you suggest in your book that conservatism has run out of gas.
Right. I think that, really conservatives don't know where to move, and you're seeing that in the relative emptiness, if you will, of President Bush's domestic program, that he's really had to scramble around to try to do something on the domestic side. I think the cause of that, as we talked about earlier, is this contradiction within the conservative coalition, that there are such diverse strains within that coalition. I mean, Jerry Falwell really doesn't have a whole lot in common with an investment banker who lives in Manhattan, that those wings simply can't agree on a way forward. I also think that they have a problem because the No New Taxes pledge was so central to their winning elections because so many middle-class people felt overtaxed. But if you're stuck on the No New Taxes pledge, as last year's budget fight showed, you really can't do much about all the domestic issues that Bush likes to talk about. You can't put more money into environmental agencies. You can't put more money into education. You can't put more money into road building. Indeed, you can't put more money into anything that might halt this recession, which is hitting some parts of the country really hard. And so because they can't really do move in one direction or another, I think they're stalled, and that's why they've run out of gas.
Who made liberalism a dirty word in mainstream politics?
Well, I think liberalism became a dirty word because it became so associated with certain forms of cultural experimentation that a lot of people didn't like. Over time, in fact, people made peace with some of those forms of cultural experimentation, like feminism. But initially, they associated it instead with Richard Nixon's old line, acid amnesty and abortion. I think that's part of the problem. I think the second part of the problem is liberalism historically under FDR and Harry Truman was associated with giving help to both the poor and the broad middle class. Probably the best piece of social legislation we ever passed in our country was the GI Bill, which basically told a whole huge cross-section of Americans that the government is going to help you go to college and it's going to help you buy a home, the two prerequisites of middle-class life. I think in the 1960s, liberals came to be seen as people who divided the country into two camps, the very wealthy and the very poor, and that they had forgotten about that great mass of people in the middle who felt government ought to pay attention to their problems. I think, again, the task of liberalism is to unite the broad middle class with the poor on behalf of a program that's going to give people real opportunity. I think liberals lost their way because they lost sight of that.
For the past few years, the question in the Democratic Party always seems to be, should the party become more liberal or move more to the center in order to become more relevant to voters in America? Do you think that that's the right question?
Yeah, I think that's entirely the wrong question. I think that this talk about should they become more liberal, should they move left or right? I mean, obviously, Democrats are not going to succeed if they are a second-rate version of the Republican Party. That's what liberals always say, and they're right. But what does moving to the center mean? In my book, I talk about the center not in terms of some ideological position, but the place where most Americans are. And what most Americans are looking for are a combination of activist government, which would make you rather liberal, but an activist government that's willing to stand up for certain kinds of values. For example, what people are looking for from welfare is a new approach that would make it easier for people to work and create some incentives for people to work. One of the proposals that's happily gained ground in Washington over time is to take working poor people, people who have families, for example, where at least one person works full time but have no health insurance and fall below the poverty line. These are people who are living by all of the rules that good middle class Americans believe in, and they're good rules. But we're not doing anything to tell these people, hey, we're proud of you and we want to help you continue to do this. What we've done by not helping the working poor is to tell people, well, you might as well be on welfare because you might get more if you're on welfare than you work. It seems to me liberals have an opportunity to cast this argument not in negative terms that we want to punish the poor, but in positive terms that we want to tell poor people we want to help and we want to make it easier for you to seize opportunities. That's what liberalism always used to be about, and I don't think it's that way in the minds of people anymore. So I don't think it's a question of moving to the center or moving to the left or moving to the right. I think it's moving toward this consensus, which I think is very strong out in the country.
Moving toward more practical look at the issues as opposed to either ideological or symbolic.
Right. I mean, ideology is supposed to inform us about how we look at the world. It's supposed to teach us something about what categories might be useful to us. It's not supposed to be a straitjacket, and I think it has become a straitjacket. So, yeah, that's what you said is exactly what I think, which is that we must We must get more practical in our politics. I mean, we're a country that faces extraordinary challenges to our economy from the Germans, from the Japanese, from the rising countries of Asia. We're a country where the middle class has sort of stagnated for the last 20 years. We're a country where we're having real problems educating our kids. Why in the world shouldn't we talk about those problems instead of having these endless symbolic arguments? I think people would respond to that. I think that's what they're looking for, and they're not getting that. And that's why they hate politics.
Okay, E.J. Dionne, I hear a lot of our listeners thinking, well, if this guy's got all of the answers, why doesn't he run for office?
Somebody at a meeting I went to where I gave a speech asked that wonderful question and said, do you have any plans to run for anything? And I said, I have no plans to run for anything, which always means the person probably intends to run for something. The answer is I've liked what I've been doing so far, and I like being a voice in the debate. I admire people who run for office, and in fact, I think it would be fun.
Do I hear you saying you're considering it?
Oh, I wouldn't say I'm seriously considering it. I just think it's a fun, I think it's an interesting task, and I admire people who do it, and I especially admire people who do it in this climate where it's pretty rough on all of them.
When you look around the world, do you think Americans are unique in hating politics?
No. That's a great question. I think that you've seen in a lot of countries in the West some of the same things that have happened to us for some of the same reasons. I think that you're seeing declining voter turnouts in a lot of other countries. But I do think that we have a particular problem. I think that most countries in Western Europe, for example, have had a much more practical orientation. They haven't demonized government the way the right has in our country. They haven't been quite so skeptical of what we sometimes mistakenly call traditional values as some liberals have in our country. I think there is a much more practical debate in a lot of Western Europe. But I do think that a kind of consumer society of the sort that we're building all over the world perhaps doesn't value public engagement in quite the same way that we may have valued it 30 years ago. I think some of the other part of it is that we have solved certain problems. I think that by and large, people are better off. In the middle of the Depression, people turned to politics urgently because it was the only place they could go to solve problems. Obviously, we don't have quite that same kind of catastrophe going on in our country. So that the move away from politics is not all bad, but I think it is largely a bad thing because it undermines people's sense that they are self-governing and ought to play a part in the process of governing themselves.
Well, E.J. Dionne, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I thank you so much.
And E.J. Dionne is a writer for The Washington Post and the author of the new book, Why Americans Hate Politics. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. You may associate the cartoon character Felix the Cat with the popular TV series, but animation historian John Canemaker says Felix's best days were when he was a silent screen star, before he was upstaged by a talking Mickey Mouse. Coming up, we meet Felix's biographer, John Canemaker. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers West Texas's other 50s rocker named Buddy, not Buddy Holly, but Buddy Knox. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. As India mourns the death of former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi, his Congress party has chosen Gandhi's Italian-born widow as the party's new leader. However, it's not certain that she will accept. Mark Tully of the BBC has more.
The Congress Working Committee, the most senior executive committee of the party, unanimously elected Sonia Gandhi to succeed her husband as party president. But the party spokesman later admitted that the position had not been offered to her yet, nor was it possible to say whether she would accept. The unanimous decision could be an attempt to put pressure on Sonia Gandhi to accept the job. She was reluctant to allow her husband to become a politician, reluctant to see him made prime minister, and has always been thought to regard politics with some distaste. It's possible, therefore, that she will refuse to take on the leadership of the Congress party. Sonia Gandhi has no direct political experience. She's never even been an elected member of a legislative assembly.
Mark Tully of the BBC in New Delhi. Testifying today on Capitol Hill, Secretary of State James Baker said that he believes there is no larger roadblock to peace in the Middle East than continuing Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. Appearing before a House Appropriations Subcommittee, Baker said that he tried on his recent trips to the Middle East to get from Arab nations an agreement to end a state of war with Israel in return for suspension of Israeli settlements. Baker said, in his words, he did not get any takers. In New York City, the UN has completed its first inspection of Iraq's nuclear facilities and has taken custody of nuclear weapons material. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
An international team of 34 experts spent a week inspecting Iraq's main nuclear research facility located at Al-Tuwaifa. The purpose was to verify the quantities and conditions of nuclear materials as stated by Baghdad in a letter to the United Nations. At the site, the International Atomic Energy Agency took custody of nuclear weapons usable material and applied verification, containment, and surveillance procedures. A second facility designated by the UN was also inspected. Under the terms of the Security Council ceasefire resolution adopted last month, Iraq's weapons of mass destruction must be destroyed, removed, or rendered harmless. Further inspections are to follow. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
Iran is charged that one of its patrol boats was attacked by a U.S. ship in the Persian Gulf. This charge came one day after U.S. officials said that two ships fired on the USS LaSalle in the Persian Gulf. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 4 points to close at 2,910. This is NPR News. According to officials, Germany and the Soviet Union have settled a controversy over contracts to build homes for Soviet troops being pulled out of eastern Germany. According to a German government official, German firms will get close to 60% of the first contracts offered in this agreement. These projects are financed by German taxpayers, and it had appeared that first contracts might go to Finnish and Turkish companies because they had made lower bids. Bonn has promised close to $9 billion to help cover the expense of withdrawing over 400,000 Soviet troops and their families from eastern Germany. Of this amount, $4.6 billion is to help build housing in the Soviet Union. In South Africa, Winnie Mandela was arrested twice today in Johannesburg while protesting on behalf of political prisoners. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
The African National Congress designated today as a day of fasting in solidarity with political prisoners who are on a hunger strike. Some have refused food since the beginning of the month, which was the deadline agreed to by the government for the release of all political prisoners. In Johannesburg, Winnie Mandela led a group of members of the ANC Women's League in a protest. They closed off a main road downtown and got arrested. After her release, she went back and continued the protest, only to be arrested again. This time, other ANC women marched to police headquarters and were detained. From a police cell, ANC Women's League Deputy President Albertina Sisulu sent a message calling on all ANC women to go to police stations and demand that they be jailed. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
A White House official has confirmed that Chief of Staff John Sununu's travel practices are now being studied by the Office of Government Ethics. The independent government agency is said to be reviewing the investigation of the Chief of Staff's travel that was conducted by the White House legal counsel. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see if you remember this TV theme.
Wonderful cat. Whenever he gets in a fix, he reaches into his bag of tricks. Felix the cat, the wonderful, wonderful cat. You laugh so much your sides will ache, your heart will go pit-a-pat. Watch and Felix the wonderful cat.
Felix the cat had his own cartoon series on TV in the late 50s and early 60s. But if you know Felix only through the TV series, you've missed what makes Felix great. That's what John Canemaker says, and he's the author of a new book called Felix, The Twisted Tale of the World's Most Famous Cat. It's the silent black-and-white Felix cartoons of the 20s that inspired Canemaker's book. Canemaker is an animator and animation historian. He's helped set the record straight on who the real creator of Felix was. Studio head Pat Sullivan took full credit for the cartoons, but animator Otto Messmer created Felix and directed the silent cartoons. There are several reasons why Canemaker thinks Felix is a very important cat.
Well, he's significant as an animated character because he's the first cartoon superstar. He's the first cartoon to have a real personality in a series of cartoons. Also, he connected very directly with audiences. He was as popular with audiences in the 1920s as Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton, and is recognizable. He was also merchandised incredibly. His image in the 1920s appeared on articles of clothing, toys, dolls, hood ornaments for automobiles, all sorts of licensed merchandise at that time. He was as big as Mickey Mouse in his day, and he was 10 years before Mickey Mouse.
You also credit Felix as being the first character that showed that cartoon characters could be invincible.
Well, yes, he's wonderful because he celebrates the cartoon as cartoon. He doesn't try to fool you with illusions. He is what he is, which is a marvelous, magical creature who can change himself into anything he wants and take different parts of his body and make them into things that he needs to get what he wants. For example, his tail was incredibly versatile. It could become a baseball bat or a fishing pole as needed and so on.
I think it's interesting his creator, Otto Messmer, felt that it was pointless to do things with animation that you could actually do with film. In other words, why animate humans?
Mm-hmm.
So he liked the idea of doing an animal and making an animal move in ways that an animal couldn't really move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's throughout the history of animation, there are two viewpoints. One of them is the Winsor McCay or Disney point of view, in which they wanted to truly convince you of the reality of the characters so that when you see Dumbo separated from his mother, you cry. Or when Bambi's mother is shot, you also cry. But then there's another group, the Emile Cole or Tex Avery or Otto Messmer School of Animation, which says this is an abstraction, and you will be convinced of the world of the abstraction as soon as you see it. You don't really need illusory three-dimensional devices to convince you that Donald Duck lives in a cartoon world, or indeed Felix the Cat lives in his cartoon world.
In creating the character of Felix, you say that Otto Messmer borrowed from Charlie Chaplin and also mm-hmm. borrowed from the Sammy Johnson character mm-hmm. in Sambo.
Mm-hmm.
Were there kind of racial stereotypes that the Felix character played on?
Yes, the films are full of the sensibilities and mores of the day. It's one part of his connection with the audience. There's all sorts of elements of sexism, racism, even a couple of examples of homophobia in the films themselves. They're isolated gags. They're part of the whole fabric of the thing, but they are there.
What are some of the typical storylines written around Felix early on?
Well, Felix was a very basic sort of character, and his needs were basic. He was always after food, shelter, or sex. And this never changed. But what's interesting in the films is how he achieved his goal. He could, as I say, change him into different objects. He could remove parts of his body, particularly his tail. And the visual gags are so wonderful. They just played on metamorphosis, which is a magic of animation that live action cannot duplicate, and were just wonderful little vehicles. I remember one character in a film called Romeo, 1927, in which he walks down his own leg as if it were a staircase, a wonderful, strange, impossible visual gag that's only possible in animation. You had asked earlier about mentioned the Charlie Chaplin influence, and that was true. It was actually a direct influence because in 1916, Mesmer animated for the Pat Sullivan Studio a series of Charlie Chaplin cartoons, and the eloquent pantomime of Chaplin and also his facial expressions went directly into Felix the Cat when that character came around 3 years later.
Now, although Otto Mesmer was the creator of Felix and drew and directed the Felix cartoons, the credit and the copyright went to Pat Sullivan, the owner of the studio. Mm. How did he end up stealing the credit for Felix?
Well, he didn't steal it. He just assumed it. He was the owner of the studio and just assumed all sorts of credit and indeed all the money from the merchandising. Mesmer was a salaried employee, and that's how Mesmer thought of himself, and that's how he was treated. I often asked Mr. Mesmer, you know, years later, why he didn't protest, and he just was incredibly diffident about it. He said, well, I was a salaried man, and I made a good salary, and that was it. He really had no sort of entrepreneur quality about him, that all of the qualities that Pat Sullivan did have. And I do mention in the book that I think Felix would not have gone as far as he did without the contributions of both men. Mesmer is the artist who preferred to stay in the studio and work just on the films and create the stories and to direct the other animators. And Sullivan, who was a promoter par excellence and really fought for contracts, and there were a whole number of legal cases and legal battles that I looked up in the course of research for the book.
What credit did Mesmer get on the cartoons themselves?
None. No visual credit.
I can't believe, even though he thought of himself as a salaried employer, that he would feel comfortable seeing these cartoons that didn't have his name on it.
Yeah, I think he wasn't comfortable with it. I don't think he admitted that, perhaps to himself, but he never admitted it to me. He never had a mean or
self-assertive.
Yeah. he didn't. He never had an angry thing to say about Sullivan. He even, you know, defended him. Of course, Sullivan had a great many personal problems, and they all stemmed from his alcoholism.
Did he end up getting any of the financial credit for Felix before he died?
No. He did get credit for what his great contribution was to the art of animation, but he never shared in any of the financial rewards. He never owned a copyright to it, although he claimed that Sullivan said, you know, on his deathbed that he would put his name in the will. Well, I found the will and years of probate after that, and there was no mention of Mesmer in the will in terms of giving him anything.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Kanemaker. He's written several books on the history of animation. His new book is called Felix, The Twisted Tale of the World's Most Famous Cat. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. John Kanemaker is my guest, the author of a new book on Felix the Cat. Felix the Cat ended up losing out to Mickey Mouse pretty early in the game. How did Mickey leave Felix behind him?
It was the introduction of sound to motion pictures that started and caused the demise of Felix the Cat. In 1928, in November, Walt Disney premiered Steamboat Willie, which was the first cartoon released publicly with Mickey Mouse, and it had a soundtrack which was a marvelously innovative one. It had effects and music and a voice of sorts, and the great thing about it was it synced up perfectly with the action, and audiences were astounded and delighted by it. And Sullivan, because Felix was such a success and because he was content with that, and also because of his alcoholism, didn't really plan to change Felix in any way. Mesmer was content to continue doing Felix as he had done, as a silent black and white character and these little visual gags and touches of personality. But Disney wanted to go further and was very ambitious and did take hold of the new technology, which he did with every new technology that came along, including three-tone Technicolor and multiplane cameras and feature-length films, and just made enormous strides immediately. And by the time Sullivan decided to compete or to catch up, it was too late. And the films that were made with sound, in the 20s and early 30s with Felix, were dreadful.
Now, after Sullivan died, what happened to the copyright?
Well, the copyright then went to his brother and his father in Australia. It took them a year to get it together to come to the United States to do something about that. The father died in the meantime. There were battles with lawyers going on. Felix really diminished as a merchandising character. The doll manufacturers who did have Felix in 1930, they switched over to Mickey Mouse. By 1936, Mesmer was still doing the comic strips. That's what he did to survive. And then eventually he started making giant electric sign animation for the Douglas Lee Organization. But in 1936, they asked a studio here in New York called the Van Buren Studio, said, would you like to make three Felix cartoons in sound and in color? And he sort of hedged on that. And so the job went to a former Disney animator who made them look and sound and act just like Mickey Mouse or Silly Symphonies. So those failed, and it wasn't until the television series in the late 50s that Felix really revived as a character. But I feel that Mesmer, as an artist, perhaps he was afraid of the new technology, but also I feel he felt he couldn't improve upon the films that he made in the 1920s. To my mind, the little black-and-white silent Felix films are gems. I think they're little masterpieces that could never be improved upon. Adding sound and color and Disney illusory devices diminished rather than enhanced their appeal.
The work that you did with Otto Mesmer, the documentary you did on him, and mm-hmm. your attempts to restore credit to him, I mean, mm-hmm. people really in the know knew about that, but the public mm-hmm. at large really didn't. Do you think that really changed his life in any fundamental way?
I think he enjoyed the recognition. I do. I remember he was delighted to get fan mail, and he was always pleased to draw Felix for people. He spent his last days making these small drawings of Felix and finally signing his name to everyone.
You will be introducing a retrospective of the early Felix the Cat cartoons at the Museum of Modern Art on May 28th. For those of us who won't be able to make it to the museum, are the early Felix the Cat cartoons on video?
Some of them are, but they're public domain, so they're not really any large label. There's some renegade labels that have them, and you have to search for them. The television ones were released last year, and they're, I think, a complete grouping of those are available commercially.
But you don't really recommend those anyways.
Well, if you like the television series, of course.
Okay, but it wouldn't give us a sense of what Felix was originally like.
No, you have to see the black and whites. And as I say, some of them are available on tape, but not as many as should be, and they're not as accessible as they should be, in my opinion.
Well, John Canemaker, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Canemaker is the author of Felix, The Twisted Tale of the World's Most Famous Cat. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on the impact of the assassination of Rajiv Gandhi?
Terry, we're going to talk about some of the issues that that we expect will be raised in the campaign to come now that the election has been delayed. And on the Nehru dynasty and what happens to that, We also have a conversation with a person who was a fairly, an uncomfortably close eyewitness to what happened to Rajiv Gandhi. We also are going to be talking about a cancer clinic that's offering a controversial new treatment, and more on the pact between Syria and Lebanon.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says there's a clear, open sound to the rock and roll that has come from West Texas, from singers like Roy Orbison, Buddy Holly, Bobby Fuller, and even today's Joe Ely. Ed says Buddy Knox is a lesser-known member of this elite society who's been overlooked.
Texans tend to be rather chauvinistic, so for many years I took it with a grain of salt when a friend of mine insisted that Buddy Knox was one of America's great unknown rock and rollers. Like everyone else, I knew Buddy Knox because of Party Doll, the number one record of 1957, but hardly one of that year's brightest moments.
Well, all I want is Party Doll, to come along with me when I'm feeling wild, to be ever-loving, true and fair, to run her fingers through my hair. Come along and be my Party Doll, come along and be my Party Doll, come along and be my Party Doll.
I always thought this friend of mine liked Buddy for two reasons. First, he was born in 1933 in Happy, Texas, one of those Texas towns whose name is good for a laugh, like Wink, home of Roy Orbison, or Earth, or Dimebox, home of nobody in particular. Second, my friend was managing the rock and roll career of his accountant and was fond of pointing out that Buddy Knox, too, had an accounting and business administration degree from West Texas State in Dumas. It was in Dumas that Knox formed a band, the Rhythm Orchids, with his friends Jimmy Bowen and Donnie Lanier. The success of their regular show on radio station KDDD there convinced them that they should make a record, so they, like Buddy Holly's crickets before them, traveled over to Norman Petty's studios in Clovis, New Mexico, and recorded Party Doll. Through a complicated series of events, the record found its way into the offices of a brand new record label in New York, Roulette, and early in 1957, Party Doll, Roulette's second release, went to the top of the charts. The label on his second single identified the artist as Lieutenant Buddy Knox because he was finishing up his military obligation and actually hung out for a weekend at Fort Hood with Private First Class Elvis Presley.
Well, when your baby is tired and she wants to sleep, take her into your arms. Tell her you love her, tell her you care, tell her about all her charms. Ooh-hoo. Ooh-hoo, ooh-hoo, ooh-hoo. Well, then you rock your little baby to sleep. Yeah, then you rock your little baby to sleep.
Rock Your Little Baby to Sleep didn't do nearly as well as Party Doll had. Still, Roulette was molding Knox into a teen idol pop singer, and it was probably records like his second big hit, Hula Love, that I remembered when my friend touted Buddy Knox's virtues.
On the Isle of Philalilla, out Hawaiian way, a hula maiden gay strolled by a moonlit bay. There cometh to court her over the water from a savage Zingazula land, a bolo chieftain grand sang her this lay. And he sang hula, a Hawaiian hula, smiled on a Zingazula moonshine above, on the sweet jungle love.
But there was something else to Buddy Knox that we probably didn't notice at the time.
Well, I'm a swinging daddy and I love that jive. Just wipe me up and I'll come alive. Throw me a woman with a style and grace. Then stand back, buddy, and give me space. Kick off my shoes and I mess her hair. And I watch a real swinging pair. Will it give me?
Swingin' Daddy is an exact contemporary of Maybe Baby by that other famous West Texas buddy, Buddy Holly. Buddy Holly was a bit harder-edged and had a more eccentric singing style. But, as the B-side of Swingin' Daddy shows, the two buddies were motivated by a lot of the same musical impulses.
Whenever I'm lonely for you. Whenever I cry, I'm crying
People listen to Buddy Holly and hear the rocker at the expense of the pop singer. They forget that his last single, It Doesn't Matter Anymore, had pizzicato strings instead of guitars and was written by Paul Anka. On the basis of a couple of syrupy records, we've written Buddy Knox off, but I've always thought that eventually we'd have done the same thing to Buddy Holly, who was definitely steering towards the middle of the road when he died. As for Buddy Knox, by 1960 his career was fading away, but not before he accomplished that ultimate rock and roll coup, getting a record banned.
So long,
so long,
to you,
to you.
I hope I don't make you blue, but I think I'm gonna kill myself. I think I'm gonna kill myself. Apart,
apart,
we've grown,
we've grown,
and I can't go on alone. So I think I'm gonna kill myself. I think I'm gonna kill myself. Now I dig my grave with a silver spade. Golden chain, let me down to down. Send my.
You can just imagine how much the rock and roll watchdogs appreciated a song like that. Buddy's old friend, former rhythm orchid Jimmy Bowen, went on to become a very successful record executive and made some records with Buddy, but nothing came of them. And eventually, Buddy married a Canadian woman and moved to a town near Winnipeg, where he still lives. He may not have been the greatest rock and roller West Texas gave us, but he's better than most of us remembered.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Our reviews and interviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, and Amy Sallet, with Robbie Harris and Soon Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we hear the story of Gad Gross, the only American reporter killed during the Gulf War. We'll talk with reporter Frank Smythe. He and Gross were traveling with the Kurds when they were pursued by Iraqi soldiers. Gross was shot. Smythe was captured. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.